This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Catch 22 by Joseph Heller, read by J.O. Sanders, featuring an archival recording of the author.
The island of Pianosa lies in the Mediterranean Sea, 8 miles south of Elba. It is very small and obviously could not accommodate all of the actions described. Like the setting of this novel, the characters, too, are fictitious. 1. The Texan. It was love at first sight. The first time Yossarian saw the chaplain, he fell madly in love with him. Yossarian was in the hospital with a pain in his liver that fell just short of being jaundice. The doctors were puzzled by the fact that it wasn't quite jaundice. If it became jaundice, they could treat it. If it didn't become jaundice and went away, they could discharge him. But this just being short of jaundice all the time confused them. Each morning they came around, three brisk and serious men with efficient mouths and inefficient eyes, accompanied by brisk and serious Nurse Duckett, one of the ward nurses who didn't like Yossarian. They read the chart at the foot of the bed and asked impatiently about the pain. They seemed irritated when he told them it was exactly the same.
"Still no movement?"
the full colonel demanded. The doctors exchanged a look when he shook his head.
"Give him another pill."
Nurse Duckett made a note to give Yossarian another pill, and the four of them moved along to the next bed. None of the nurses liked Yossarian. Actually, the pain in his liver had gone away, but Yossarian didn't say anything, and the doctors never suspected. They just suspected that he had been moving his bowels and not telling anyone. Yossarian had everything he wanted in the hospital. The food wasn't too bad, and his meals were brought to him in bed. There were extra rations of fresh meat, and during the hot part of the afternoon, he and the others were served chilled fruit juice or chilled chocolate milk. Apart from the doctors and the nurses, no one ever disturbed him. For a little while in the morning, he had to censor letters, but he was free after that to spend the rest of each day lying around idly with a clear conscience. He was comfortable in the hospital, and it was easy to stay on because he always ran a temperature of 101. He was even more comfortable than Dunbar, who had to keep falling down on his face in order to get his meals brought to him in bed. After he made up his mind to spend the rest of the war in the hospital, Yossarian wrote letters to everyone he knew, saying that he was in the hospital, but never mentioning why. One day, he had a better idea. To everyone he knew, he wrote that he was going on a very dangerous mission.
"They asked for volunteers. It's very dangerous, but someone has to do it. I'll write you the instant I get back."
And he had not written anyone since.
All the officer patients in the ward were forced to censor letters written by all the enlisted men patients, who were kept in residence in wards of their own. It was a monotonous job, and Yossarian was disappointed to learn that the lives of enlisted men were only slightly more interesting than the lives of officers. After the first day, he had no curiosity at all. To break the monotony, he invented games. "Death to all modifiers," he declared one day, and out of every letter that passed through his hands went every adverb and every adjective. The next day he made war on articles. He reached a much higher plane of creativity the following day, when he blacked out everything in the letters but A, an, and the. That erected more dynamic intralinear tensions, he felt, and in just about every case left a message far more universal. Soon he was proscribing parts of salutations and signatures and leaving the text untouched. One time he blacked out all but the salutation, "Dear Mary," from a letter, and at the bottom he wrote,
"I yearn for you tragically. A.T. Tappan, Chaplain, U.S. Army."
A.T. Tapman was the group chaplain's name. When he had exhausted all possibilities in the letters, he began attacking the names and addresses on the envelopes, obliterating whole homes and streets, annihilating entire metropolises with careless flicks of his wrist, as though he were God. Catch-22 required that each censored letter bear the censoring officer's name. Most letters he didn't read at all. On those he didn't read at all, he wrote his own name. On those he did read, he wrote Washington Irving. When that grew monotonous, he wrote Irving Washington. Censoring the envelopes had serious repercussions, produced a ripple of anxiety on some ethereal military echelon that floated a CID man back into the ward posing as a patient. They all knew he was a CID man because he kept inquiring about an officer named Irving or Washington, and because after his first day there, he wouldn't censor letters. He found them too monotonous. It was a good ward this time, one of the best he and Dunbar had ever enjoyed. With them this time was the 24-year-old fighter pilot captain with the sparse golden mustache who had been shot down in the Adriatic Sea in midwinter and had not even caught cold. Now the summer was upon them, the captain had not been shot down, and he said he had the grip. In the bed on Yusarian's right, lying amorously on his belly, was the startled captain with malaria in his blood and a mosquito bite on his ass. Across the aisle from Yusarian was Dunbar, and next to Dunbar was the artillery captain with whom Yusarian had stopped playing chess. The captain was a good chess player, and the games were always interesting. Yusarian had stopped playing chess with him because the games were so interesting they were foolish. Then there was the educated Texan from Texas, who looked like someone in Technicolor, and felt, patriotically, that people of means, decent folk, should be given more votes than drifters, whores, criminals, degenerates, atheists, and indecent folk, people without means. Yusarian was unspringing rhythms in the letters the day they brought the Texan in. It was another quiet, hot, untroubled day. The heat pressed heavily on the roof, stifling sound. Dunbar was lying motionless on his back again, with his eyes staring up at the ceiling like a doll's. He was working hard at increasing his lifespan. He did it by cultivating boredom. Dunbar was working so hard at increasing his lifespan that Yusarian thought he was dead. They put the Texan in a bed in the middle of the ward, and it wasn't long before he donated his views. Dunbar sat up like a shot.
"That's it!" he cried excitedly. "There was something missing. All the time I knew there was something missing, and now I know what it is."
He banged his fist down into his palm.
"No patriotism," he declared.
"You're right," Yusarian shouted back. "You're right, you're right, you're right. The hot dog, the Brooklyn Dodgers, mom's apple pie. That's what everyone's fighting for. But who's fighting for the decent folk? Who's fighting for more votes for the decent folk? There's no patriotism, that's what it is. And no matriotism, either."
The warrant officer on Yusarian's left was unimpressed.
"Who gives a shit?" he asked tiredly and turned over on his side to go to sleep.
The Texan turned out to be good-natured, generous, and likable. In 3 days, no one could stand him. He sent shudders of annoyance scampering up ticklish spines, and everybody fled from him. Everybody but the soldier in white, who had no choice. The soldier in white was encased from head to toe in plaster and gauze. He had 2 useless legs and 2 useless arms. He had been smuggled into the ward during the night, and the men had no idea he was among them until they awoke in the morning and saw the 2 strange legs hoisted from the hips, the 2 strange arms anchored up perpendicularly, all 4 limbs pinioned strangely in air by lead weight suspended darkly above him that never moved. Sewn into the bandages over the insides of both elbows were zippered lips through which he was fed clear fluid from a clear jar. A silent zinc pipe rose from the cement on his groin and was coupled to a slim rubber hose that carried waste from his kidneys and dripped it efficiently into a clear stoppered jar on the floor. When the jar on the floor was full, the jar feeding his elbow was empty, and the 2 were simply switched quickly so that stuff could drip back into him. All they ever really saw of the soldier in white was a frayed black hole over his mouth.
The soldier in white had been filed next to the Texan, and the Texan sat sideways on his own bed and talked to him throughout the morning, afternoon, and evening in a pleasant, sympathetic drawl. The Texan never minded that he got no reply. Temperatures were taken twice a day in the ward. Early each morning and late each afternoon, Nurse Kramer entered with a jar full of thermometers and worked her way up one side of the ward and down the other, distributing a thermometer to each patient. She managed the soldier in white by inserting a thermometer into the hole over his mouth and leaving it balanced there on the lower rim. When she returned to the man in the first bed, she took his thermometer and recorded his temperature, and then moved on to the next bed and continued around the ward again. One afternoon, when she had completed her first circuit of the ward and came a second time to the soldier in white, she read his temperature and discovered that he was dead.
"Murderer?" Dunbar said quietly.
The Texan looked up at him with an uncertain grin.
"Killer?"
Yossarian said.
"What are you talking about?"
the Texan asked nervously.
"You murdered him,"
said Dunbar.
"You killed him,"
said Yossarian. The Texan shrank back.
"You fellows are crazy. I didn't even touch him." "You murdered him,"
said Dunbar.
"I heard you kill him," said Yossarian. "You killed him because he was a nigger,"
Dunbar said.
"You fellows are crazy," the Texan cried. "They don't allow niggers in here. They got a special place for niggers."
"The sergeant smuggled him in," Dunbar said.
The communist sergeant," said Yossarian. "And you knew it."
The warrant officer on Yossarian's left was unimpressed by the entire incident of the soldier in white. The warrant officer was unimpressed by everything and never spoke at all unless it was to show irritation. The day before Yossarian met the chaplain, a stove exploded in the mess hall and set fire to one side of the kitchen. An intense heat flashed through the area. Even in Yossarian's ward, almost 300 feet away, they could hear the roar of the blaze and the sharp cracks of flaming timber. Smoke sped past the orange-tinted windows. In about 15 minutes, the crash trucks from the airfield arrived to fight the fire. For a frantic half-hour, it was touch and go. Then the firemen began to get the upper hand. Suddenly, there was the monotonous old drone of bombers returning from a mission, and the firemen had to roll up their hoses and speed back to the field in case one of the planes crashed and caught fire. The planes landed safely. As soon as the last one was down, the firemen wheeled their trucks around and raced back up the hill to resume their fight with the fire at the hospital. When they got there, the blaze was out. It had died of its own accord, expired completely without even an ember to be watered down, and there was nothing for the disappointed firemen to do but drink tepid coffee and hang around trying to screw the nurses. The chaplain arrived the day after the fire. Yossarian was busy expurgating all but romance words from the letters when the chaplain sat down in a chair between the beds and asked him how he was feeling. He had placed himself a bit to one side, and the captain's bars on the tab of his shirt collar were all the insignia Yossarian could see. Yossarian had no idea who he was and just took it for granted that he was either another doctor or another madman.
"Oh, pretty good," he answered. "I've got a slight pain in my liver, and I haven't been the most regular of fellows, I guess, but all in all, I must admit that I feel pretty good."
"That's good," said the chaplain.
"Yes," Yossarian said. "Yes, that is good."
"I meant to come around sooner," the chaplain said, "but I really haven't been well."
"Well, that's too bad," Yossarian said. "Just a head cold," the chaplain added quickly. "I've got a fever of 101. Yossarian added just as quickly.
"That's too bad," said the chaplain.
"Yes," Yossarian agreed. "Yes, that is too bad."
The chaplain fidgeted.
"Is there anything I can do for you?"
he asked after a while.
"No, no," Yossarian sighed. "The doctors are doing all that's humanly possible, I suppose."
"No, no," the chaplain colored faintly. I didn't mean anything like that. I meant cigarettes, or books, or toys."
"No, no," Yossarian said. "Thank you. I have everything I need, I suppose, everything but good health."
"That's too bad."
"Yes," Yossarian said. "Yes, that is too bad."
The chaplain stirred again. He looked from side to side a few times, then gazed up at the ceiling, then down at the floor. He drew a deep breath.
"Lieutenant Nately sends his regards," he said.
Yossarian was sorry to hear they had a mutual friend. It seemed there was a basis to their conversation after all.
"You know Lieutenant Nately?" he asked regretfully. "Yes, I know Lieutenant Nately quite well."
"He's a bit loony, isn't he?"
The chaplain's smile was embarrassed.
"I'm afraid I couldn't say. I don't think I know him that well."
"You can take my word for it," Yossarian said. "He's as goofy as they come."
The chaplain weighed the next silence heavily and then shattered it with an abrupt question.
"You are Captain Yossarian, aren't you?"
"Nately had a bad start. He came from a good family."
"Please excuse me," the chaplain persisted timorously. "I may be committing a very grave error. Are you Captain Yossarian?"
"Yes," Captain Yossarian confessed. "I am Captain Yossarian."
"Of the 256th Squadron?"
"Of the fighting 256th Squadron," Yossarian replied. "I didn't know there were any other Captain Yossarians. As far as I know, I'm the only Captain Yossarian I know, but that's only as far as I know."
"I see,"
the chaplain said unhappily.
"That's two to the fighting 8th power," Yossarian pointed out, "if you're thinking of writing a symbolic poem about our squadron."
"No," mumbled the chaplain. "I'm not thinking of writing a symbolic poem about your squadron."
Yossarian straightened sharply when he spied the tiny silver cross on the other side of the chaplain's collar. He was thoroughly astonished, for he had never really talked with a chaplain before.
"You're a chaplain!" he exclaimed ecstatically. "I didn't know you were a chaplain!"
"Why, yes," the chaplain answered. "Didn't you know I was a chaplain?"
"Well, no, I didn't know you were a chaplain."
Yossarian stared at him with a big, fascinated grin.
"I've never really seen a chaplain before."
The chaplain flushed again and gazed down at his hands. He was a slight man of about 32, with tan hair and brown, diffident eyes. His face was narrow and rather pale. An innocent nest of ancient pimple pricks lay in the basin of each cheek. Yossarian wanted to help him.
"Can I do anything at all to help you?"
the chaplain asked.
Yossarian shook his head, still grinning. "No, I'm sorry. I have everything I need, and I'm quite comfortable. In fact, I'm not even sick."
"Well, that's good."
As soon as the chaplain said the words, he was sorry and shoved his knuckles into his mouth with a giggle of alarm, but Yossarian remained silent and disappointed him.
"There are other men in the group I must visit,"
he apologized finally.
"I'll come see you again, probably tomorrow."
"Please do that," Yossarian said.
"I'll only come if you want me to,"
the chaplain said, lowering his head shyly.
"I've noticed that I make many of the men uncomfortable."
Yossarian glowed with affection.
"I want you to," he said. "You won't make me uncomfortable."
The chaplain beamed gratefully and then peered down at a slip of paper he had been concealing in his hand all the while. He counted along the beds in the ward, moving his lips, and then centered his attention dubiously on Dunbar.
"May I inquire," he whispered softly, "if that is Lieutenant Dunbar?"
"Yes," Yossarian answered loudly. "That is Lieutenant Dunbar."
"Thank you,"
the chaplain whispered.
"Thank you very much. I must visit with him. I must visit with every member of the group who is in the hospital."
"Even those in the other wards?" Yossarian asked.
"Even those in the other wards."
"Be careful in those other wards, Father," Yossarian warned.
"That's where they keep the mental cases. They're filled with lunatics." "It isn't necessary to call me Father," the chaplain explained. "I'm an Anabaptist."
"I'm dead serious about those other wards," Yossarian continued grimly. "MPs won't protect you, because they're the craziest of all. I'd go with you myself, but I'm scared stiff."
"Insanity is contagious. This is the only sane ward in the whole hospital. Everybody is crazy but us.
This is probably the only sane ward in the whole world, for that matter."
The chaplain rose quickly and edged away from Yossarian's bed, and then nodded with a conciliating smile and promised to conduct himself with appropriate caution.
"And now I must visit with Lieutenant Dunbar," he said.
Still he lingered remorsefully.
"How is Lieutenant Dunbar?"
he asked at last.
"As good as they go," Yossarian assured him.
a true prince, one of the finest, least dedicated men in the whole world.
I didn't mean that, the chaplain answered, whispering again. Is he very sick?
No, he isn't very sick. In fact, he isn't sick at all.
That's good, the chaplain sighed with relief.
Yes, Yossarian said. Yes, that is good.
A chaplain, Dunbar said when the chaplain had visited him and gone. Did you see that? A chaplain.
Wasn't he sweet? Said Yossarian. Maybe they should give him 3 votes.
Who's they? Dunbar demanded suspiciously. In a bed in the small private section at the end of the ward, always working ceaselessly behind the green plyboard partition, was the solemn middle-aged colonel who was visited every day by a gentle, sweet-faced woman with curly ash-blonde hair, who was not a nurse, and not a whack, and not a Red Cross girl, but who nevertheless appeared faithfully at the hospital in Pianosa each afternoon wearing pretty pastel summer dresses that were very smart, and white leather pumps with heels half-high at the base of nylon seams that were inevitably straight. The colonel was in communications, and he was kept busy day and night, transmitting glutinous messages from the interior into square pads of gauze, which he sealed meticulously and delivered to a covered white pail that stood on the night table beside his bed. The colonel was gorgeous. He had a cavernous mouth, cavernous cheeks, cavernous, sad, mildewed eyes. His face was the color of clouded silver. He coughed quietly, gingerly, and dabbed the pads slowly at his lips with a distaste that had become automatic. The colonel dwelt in a vortex of specialists who were still specializing in trying to determine what was troubling him. They hurled lights in his eyes to see if he could see, rammed needles into nerves to hear if he could feel. There was a urologist for his urine, a lymphologist for his lymph, an endocrinologist for his endocrines, a psychologist for his psyche, a dermatologist for his derma. There was a pathologist for his pathos, a cystologist for his cysts, and a bald and pedantic cetologist from the zoology department at Harvard who had been shanghaied ruthlessly into the medical corps by a faulty anode in an IBM machine and spent his sessions with the dying colonel trying to discuss Moby Dick with him. The colonel had really been investigated. There was not an organ of his body that had not been drugged and derogated, dusted and dredged, fingered and photographed, removed, plundered, and replaced. Neat, slender, and erect, the woman touched him often as she sat by his bedside and was the epitome of stately sorrow each time she smiled. The colonel was tall, thin, and stooped. When he rose to walk, he bent forward even more, making a deep cavity of his body, and placed his feet down very carefully, moving ahead by inches from the knees down. There were violet pools under his eyes. The woman spoke softly, softer even than the colonel coughed, and none of the men in the ward ever heard her voice. In less than 10 days, the Texan cleared the ward. The artillery captain broke first, and after that the exodus started. Dunbar, Yossarian, and the fighter captain all bolted the same morning. Dunbar stopped having dizzy spells, and the fighter captain blew his nose. Yossarian told the doctors that the pain in his liver had gone away. It was as easy as that. Even the warrant officer fled. In less than 10 days, the Texan drove everybody in the ward back to duty. Everybody but the CID man, who had caught cold from the fighter captain and come down with pneumonia. 2. Clevenger. In a way, the CID man was pretty lucky because outside the hospital, the war was still going on. Men went mad and were rewarded with medals. All over the world, boys on every side of the bomb line were laying down their lives for what they had been told was their country, and no one seemed to mind, least of all the boys who were laying down their young lives. There was no end in sight. The only end in sight was Yossarian's own, and he might have remained in the hospital until doomsday had it not been for that patriotic Texan with his infundibuliform jowls and his lumpy, rumple-headed, indestructible smile cracked forever across the front of his face like the brim of a black 10-gallon hat. The Texan wanted everybody in the ward to be happy.
but Yossarian and Dunbar. He was really very sick. But Yossarian couldn't be happy, even though the Texan didn't want him to be, because outside the hospital, there was still nothing funny going on. The only thing going on was a war, and no one seemed to notice but Yossarian and Dunbar. And when Yossarian tried to remind people, they drew away from him and thought he was crazy. Even Clevenger, who should have known better but didn't, had told him he was crazy the last time they had seen each other, which was just before Yossarian had fled into the hospital. Clevenger had stared at him with apoplectic rage and indignation, and, clawing the table with both hands, had shouted, "You're crazy!" "Clevenger, what do you want from people?" Dunbar had replied wearily above the noises of the officers' club. "I'm not joking," Clevenger persisted. "They're trying to kill me," Yossarian told him calmly. "No one's trying to kill you," Clevenger cried. "Then why are they shooting at me?" Yossarian asked. "They're shooting at everyone," Clevenger answered. "They're trying to kill everyone." "And what difference does that make?" Clevenger was already on the way, half out of his chair with emotion, his eyes moist and his lips quivering and pale. As always occurred when he quarreled over principles in which he believed passionately, he would end up gasping furiously for air and blinking back bitter tears of conviction. There were many principles in which Clevenger believed passionately. He was crazy. "Who's they?" he wanted to know. "Who, specifically, do you think is trying to murder you?"
"Every one of them," Yossarian told him.
"Every one of whom?"
"Every one of whom do you think?"
"I haven't any idea."
"Then how do you know they aren't?"
"Because..."
Clevenger sputtered and turned speechless with frustration.
Clevenger really thought he was right, but Yossarian had proof. Because strangers he didn't know shot at him with cannons every time he flew up into the air to drop bombs on them. And it wasn't funny at all.
And if that wasn't funny, there were lots of things that weren't even funnier. There was nothing funny about living like a bum in a tent in Pianosa, between fat mountains behind him and a placid blue sea in front, that could gulp down a person with a cramp in the twinkling of an eye and ship him back to shore 3 days later. All charges paid, bloated, blue and putrescent, water draining out through both cold nostrils. The tent he lived in stood right smack up against the wall of the shallow, dull-colored forest, separating his own squadron from Dunbar's. Immediately alongside was the abandoned railroad ditch that carried the pipe that carried the aviation gasoline down to the fuel trucks at the airfield. Thanks to Orr, his roommate, it was the most luxurious tent in the squadron. Each time Yossarian returned from one of his holidays in the hospital or rest leaves in Rome, he was surprised by some new comfort Orr had installed in his absence. Running water, wood-burning fireplace, cement floor. Yossarian had chosen the site, and he and Orr had raised the tent together. Orr, who was a grinning pygmy with pilot's wings and thick, wavy brown hair parted in the middle, furnished all the knowledge, while Yossarian, who was taller, stronger, broader, and faster, did most of the work. Just the two of them lived there, although the tent was big enough for six. When summer came, Orr rolled up the side flaps to allow a breeze that never blew to flush away the air baking inside. Immediately next door to Yossarian was Havermeyer, who liked peanut brittle and lived all by himself in the two-man tent in which he shot tiny field mice every night with huge bullets from the .45 he had stolen from the dead man in Yossarian's tent. On the other side of Havermeyer stood the tent McWatt, no longer shared with Clevenger, who had still not returned when Yossarian came out of the hospital. McWatt shared his tent now with Nately, who was away in Rome courting the sleepy whore he had fallen so deeply in love with there, who was bored with her work and bored with him, too. McWatt was crazy. He was a pilot, and flew his plane as low as he dared over Yossarian's tent as often as he could, just to see how much he could frighten him, and loved to go buzzing with a wild, close roar over the wooden raft floating on empty oil drums out past the sandbar at the immaculate white beach, where the men went swimming naked. Sharing a tent with a man who was crazy wasn't easy, but Nately didn't care.
He was crazy, too, and had gone every free day to work on the officers' club that Yossarian had not helped build. Actually, there were many officers' clubs that Yossarian had not helped build, but he was proudest of the one on Pianosa. It was a sturdy and complex monument to his powers of determination. Yossarian never went there to help until it was finished. Then he went there often, so pleased was he with the large, fine, rambling shingled building. It was truly a splendid structure, and Yossarian throbbed with a mighty sense of accomplishment each time he gazed at it and reflected that none of the work that had gone into it was his. There were four of them seated together at a table in the officers' club the last time he and Clevenger had called each other crazy. They were seated in back near the crap table on which Appleby always managed to win. Appleby was as good at shooting crap as he was at playing ping-pong, and he was as good at playing ping-pong as he was at everything else. Everything Appleby did, he did well. Appleby was a fair-haired boy from Iowa who believed in God, motherhood, and the American way of life, without ever thinking about any of them, and everybody who knew him liked him.
"I hate that son of a bitch," Yossarian growled.
The argument with Clevenger had begun a few minutes earlier when Yossarian had been unable to find a machine gun. It was a busy night. The bar was busy, the crap table was busy, the ping-pong table was busy. The people Yossarian wanted a machine gun were busy at the bar singing sentimental old favorites that nobody else ever tired of. Instead of machine-gunning them, he brought his heel down hard on the ping-pong ball that came rolling toward him off the paddle of one of the two officers playing.
"That, Yossarian," the two officers laughed, shaking their heads, and got another ball from the box on the shelf. "That, Yossarian," Yossarian answered them.
"Yossarian," Nately whispered cautioningly.
"You see what I mean?"
asked Clevenger. The officers laughed again when they heard Yossarian mimicking them.
"That, Yossarian," they said more loudly. "That, Yossarian," Yossarian echoed.
"Yossarian, please," Nately pleaded. "You see what I mean?" asked Clevenger. "He has antisocial aggressions."
"Oh, shut up,"
Dunbar told Clevenger. Dunbar liked Clevenger because Clevenger annoyed him and made the time go slow.
"Appleby isn't even here,"
Clevenger pointed out triumphantly to Yossarian.
"Who said anything about Appleby?" Yossarian wanted to know.
"Colonel Cathcart isn't here either."
"Who said anything about Colonel Cathcart?"
"What, son of a bitch, do you hate then?"
"What son of a bitch is here?"
"I'm not going to argue with you," Clevenger decided. "You don't know who you hate."
"Whoever's trying to poison me," Yossarian told him.
"Nobody's trying to poison you."
"They poisoned my food twice, didn't they? Didn't they put poison in my food during Ferrara and during the great big siege of Bologna?"
"They put poison in everybody's food,"
Clevenger explained.
"And what difference does that make?"
"And it wasn't even poison,"
Clevenger cried heatedly, growing more emphatic as he grew more confused. As far back as Yossarian could recall, he explained to Clevenger with a patient smile, somebody was always hatching a plot to kill him. There were people who cared for him and people who didn't, and those who didn't hated him and were out to get him. They hated him because he was a Syrian. But they couldn't touch him, he told Clevenger, because he had a sound mind and a pure body and was as strong as an ox. They couldn't touch him because he was Tarzan Mandrake Flash Gordon. He was Bill Shakespeare. He was Cain, Ulysses, the Flying Dutchman. He was Lot in Sodom, Deirdre of the Sorrows, Sweeney in the Nightingales Among Trees. He was Miracle Ingredient Z-247. He was crazy, Clevenger interrupted, shrieking. That's what you are, crazy.
Immense. I'm a real slam-bang, honest-to-goodness, three-fisted humdinger. I'm a bona fide Superman.
Superman? Clevenger cried.
Superman? Supraman, Yossarian corrected.
Hey, fellas, cut it out, Nately begged with embarrassment. Everybody's looking at us. You're crazy,
Clevenger shouted vehemently, his eyes filling with tears. You've got a Jehovah complex!
I think everyone is Nathaniel.
Clevenger arrested himself in mid-declamation suspiciously.
Who's Nathaniel?
Nathaniel who?
Inquired Yossarian innocently.
Clevenger skirted the trap neatly. You think everybody is Jehovah? You're no better than Raskolnikov.
Who?
Yes, Raskolnikov, who...
Raskolnikov?
Who, I mean it, who felt he could justify killing an old woman.
No better than?
Yes, justify, that's right, with an axe, and I can prove it to you.
Gasping furiously for air, Clevenger enumerated Yossarian's symptoms. An unreasonable belief that everybody around him was crazy, a homicidal impulse to machine gun strangers, retrospective falsification, an unfounded suspicion that people hated him and were conspiring to kill him.
But Yossarian knew he was right, because, as he explained to Clevenger, to the best of his knowledge, he had never been wrong. Everywhere he looked was a nut, and it was all a sensible young gentleman like himself could do to maintain his perspective amid so much madness. And it was urgent that he did, for he knew his life was in peril.
Yossarian eyed everyone he saw warily when he returned to the squadron from the hospital. Milo was away, too, in Smyrna for the fig harvest. The mess hall ran smoothly in Milo's absence. Yossarian had responded ravenously to the pungent aroma of spicy lamb while he was still in the cab of the ambulance bouncing down along the knotted road that lay like a broken suspender between the hospital and the squadron. There was shish kebab for lunch, huge, savory hunks of spitted meat sizzling like the devil over charcoal after marinating 72 hours in a secret mixture Milo had stolen from a crooked trader in the Levant. Served with Iranian rice and asparagus tips parmesan, followed by cherries jubilee for dessert, and then steaming cups of fresh coffee with Benedictine and brandy. The meal was served in enormous helpings on damask tablecloths by the skilled Italian waiters Major de Coverley had kidnapped from the mainland and given to Milo. Yossarian gorged himself in the mess hall until he thought he would explode, and then sagged back in a contented stupor, his mouth filmy with a succulent residue. None of the officers in the squadron had ever eaten so well as they ate regularly in Milo's mess hall, and Yossarian wondered a while if it wasn't perhaps all worth it. But then he burped and remembered that they were trying to kill him, and he sprinted out of the mess hall wildly and ran looking for Doc Danica to have himself taken off combat duty and sent home. He found Dr. Danica in sunlight, sitting on a high stool outside his tent.
50 missions, Dr. Danica told him, shaking his head. The colonel wants 50 missions.
But I've only got 44.
Dr. Danica was unmoved. He was a sad, bird-like man with the spatulate face and scrubbed, tapering features of a well-groomed rat.
50 missions, he repeated, still shaking his head. The colonel wants 50 missions.
3. Havemeyer.
Actually, no one was around when Yossarian returned from the hospital, but Orr and the dead man in Yossarian's tent. The dead man in Yossarian's tent was a pest, and Yossarian didn't like him, even though he had never seen him. Having him lying around all day annoyed Yossarian so much that he had gone to the orderly room several times to complain to Sergeant Towser, who refused to admit that the dead man even existed, which, of course, he no longer did. It was still more frustrating to try to appeal directly to Major Major, the long and bony squadron commander who looked a little bit like Henry Fonda in distress, and went jumping out the window of his office each time Yossarian bullied his way past Sergeant Towser to speak to him about it. The dead man in Yossarian's tent was simply not easy to live with. He even disturbed Orr, who was not easy to live with either.
and who, on the day Yossarian came back, was tinkering with the faucet that fed gasoline into the stove he had started building while Yossarian was in the hospital.
"What are you doing?"
Yossarian asked guardedly when he entered the tent, although he saw it once.
"There's a leak here," Orr said. "I'm trying to fix it."
"Please stop it," said Yossarian. "You're making me nervous."
"When I was a kid," Orr replied, "I used to walk around all day with crabapples in my cheeks, one in each cheek."
Yossarian put aside the musette bag from which he had begun removing his toilet articles and braced himself suspiciously. A minute passed.
"Why?"
he found himself forced to ask finally. Orr tittered triumphantly.
"Because they're better than horse chestnuts," he answered.
Orr was kneeling on the floor of the tent. He worked without pause, taking the faucet apart, spreading all the tiny pieces out carefully, counting and then studying each one interminably as though he had never seen anything remotely similar before, and then reassembling the whole small apparatus over and over and over and over again, with no loss of patience or interest, no sign of fatigue, no indication of ever concluding. Yossarian watched him tinkering and felt certain he would be compelled to murder him in cold blood if he did not stop. His eyes moved toward the hunting knife that had been slung over the mosquito net bar by the dead man the day he arrived. The knife hung beside the dead man's empty leather gun holster, from which Havermeyer had stolen the gun.
"When I couldn't get crab apples," Orr continued, "I used horse chestnuts. Horse chestnuts are about the same size as crab apples and actually have a better shape, although the shape doesn't matter a bit."
"Why did you walk around with crab apples in your cheeks?" Yossarian asked again.
"That's what I asked." "Because they got a better shape than horse chestnuts," Orr answered. "I just told you that."
"Why?" swore Yossarian at him approvingly. "You evil-eyed, mechanically aptituded, disaffiliated son of a bitch. Did you walk around with anything in your cheeks?"
"I didn't," Orr said. "Walk around with anything in my cheeks? I walked around with crab apples in my cheeks. When I couldn't get crab apples, I walked around with horse chestnuts in my cheeks."
Orr giggled. Yossarian made up his mind to keep his mouth shut, and did. Orr waited. Yossarian waited longer.
"One in each cheek," Orr said.
"Why?" Orr pounced.
"Why what?"
Yossarian shook his head, smiling, and refused to say.
"There's a funny thing about this valve," Orr mused aloud.
"What is?" Yossarian asked.
"Because I wanted..."
Yossarian knew.
"Jesus Christ! Why did you want apple cheeks?"
"Apple cheeks?" Yossarian demanded.
"I wanted apple cheeks," Orr repeated. "Even when I was a kid, I wanted apple cheeks someday, and I decided to work at it until I got them. And by God, I did work at it until I got them, and that's how I did it, with crab apples in my cheeks all day long."
He giggled again.
"One in each cheek."
"Why did you want apple cheeks?"
"I didn't want apple cheeks," Orr said. "I wanted big cheeks. I didn't care about the color so much, but I wanted them big. I worked at it just like one of those crazy guys you read about who go around squeezing rubber balls all day long just to strengthen their hands. In fact, I was one of those crazy guys. I used to walk around all day with rubber balls in my hands, too."
"Why?"
"Why what?"
"Why did you walk around all day with rubber balls in your hands?"
"Because rubber balls," said Orr,
"are better than crab apples?" Orr sniggered as he shook his head.
"I did it to protect my good reputation in case anyone ever caught me walking around with crabapples in my cheeks. With rubber balls in my hands, I could deny that there were crabapples in my cheeks. Every time someone asked me why I was walking around with crabapples in my cheeks, I just opened my hands and showed them it was rubber balls I was walking around with, not crabapples, and that they were in my hands, not my cheeks. It was a good story. But I never knew if it got across or not, since it's pretty tough to make people understand you when you're talking to them with two crabapples in your cheeks."
Yossarian found it pretty tough to understand him then, and he wondered once again if Orr wasn't talking to him with the tip of his tongue in one of his apple cheeks. Yossarian decided not to utter another word. It would be futile. He knew Orr, and he knew there was not a chance in hell of finding out from him then why he had wanted Big Cheeks. It would do no more good to ask than it had done to ask him why that whore had kept beating him over the head with her shoe that morning in Rome, in the cramped vestibule outside the open door of Nately's whore's kid sister's room. She was a tall, strapping girl, with long hair and incandescent blue veins converging populously beneath her cocoa-colored skin where the flesh was most tender. And she kept cursing and shrieking and jumping high up into the air on her bare feet to keep right on hitting him on the top of his head with the spiked heel of her shoe. They were both naked, and raising a rumpus that brought everyone in the apartment into the hall to watch, each couple in a bedroom doorway, all of them naked except the aproned and sweatered old woman who clucked reprovingly, and the lecherous, dissipated old man who cackled aloud hilariously through the whole episode with a kind of avid and superior glee. The girl shrieked, and Orr giggled. Each time she landed with the heel of her shoe, Orr giggled louder, infuriating her still further, so that she flew up still higher into the air for another shot at his noodle, her wondrously full breasts soaring all over the place like billowing pennants in a strong wind, and her buttocks and strong thighs shim-sham shimmying this way and that like some horrifying bonanza. She shrieked, and Orr giggled right up to the time she shrieked and knocked him cold with a good solid crack on the temple that made him stop giggling, and sent him off to the hospital in a stretcher with a hole in his head that wasn't very deep, and a very mild concussion that kept him out of combat only 12 days. Nobody could find out what had happened, not even the cackling old man and clucking old woman, who were in a position to find out everything that happened in that vast and endless brothel, with its multitudinous bedrooms on facing sides of the narrow hallways going off in opposite directions from the spacious sitting room with its shaded windows and single lamp. Every time she met Orr after that, she'd hoist her skirts up over her tight white elastic panties and, jeering coarsely, bulge her firm round belly out at him, cursing him contemptuously and then roaring with husky laughter as she saw him giggle fearfully and take refuge behind Yossarian. Whatever he had done or tried to do or failed to do behind the closed door of Nately's whore's kid sister's room was still a secret. The girl wouldn't tell Nately's whore or any of the other whores or Nately or Yossarian. Or might tell, but Yossarian had decided not to utter another word.
"Do you want to know why I wanted Big Cheeks?" Orr asked.
Yossarian kept his mouth shut.
"Do you remember," Orr said, "that time in Rome when that girl who couldn't stand you kept hitting me over the head with the heel of her shoe? Do you want to know why she was hitting me?"
It was still impossible to imagine what he could have done to make her angry enough to hammer him over the head for 15 or 20 minutes, yet not angry enough to pick him up by the ankles and dash his brains out. She was certainly tall enough, and Orr was certainly short enough. Orr had buck teeth and bulging eyes to go with his big cheeks, and was even smaller than young Hoople, who lived on the wrong side of the railroad tracks in the tent in the administration area in which Hungry Joe lay screaming in his sleep every night. The administration area in which Hungry Joe had pitched his tent by mistake lay in the center of the squadron between the ditch with its rusted railroad tracks and the tilted black bituminous road. The men could pick up girls along that road if they promised to take them where they wanted to go. Buxom, young, homely, grinning girls with missing teeth whom they could drive off the road and lie down in the wild grass with. And Yossarian did whenever he could, which was not nearly as often as Hungry Joe, who could get a jeep but couldn't drive, begged him to try. The tents of the enlisted men in the squadron stood on the other side of the road alongside the open-air movie theater, in which, for the daily amusement of the dying, ignorant armies clashed by night on a collapsible screen, and to which another USO troop came that same afternoon. The USO troops were sent by General P.P. Peckham, who had moved his headquarters up to Rome and had nothing better to do while he schemed against General Dreidel. General Peckham was a general with whom neatness definitely counted. He was a spry, suave, and very precise general, who knew the circumference of the equator and always wrote enhanced when he meant increased. He was a prick, and no one knew this better than General Dreidel, who was incensed by General Peckham's recent directive requiring all tents in the Mediterranean theater of operations to be pitched along parallel lines with entrances facing back proudly toward the Washington Monument. To General Dreidel, who ran a fighting outfit, it seemed like a lot of crap. Furthermore, it was none of General Peckham's goddamn business how the tents in General Dreidel's wing were pitched. There then followed a hectic jurisdictional dispute between these overlords that was decided in General Dreidel's favor by ex-PFC Wintergreen, mail clerk at 27th Air Force Headquarters. Wintergreen determined the outcome by throwing all communications from General Peckham into the wastebasket. He found them too prolix. General Dreidel's views, expressed in less pretentious literary style, pleased ex-PFC Wintergreen and were sped along by him in zealous observance of regulations. General Dreidel was victorious by default. To regain whatever status he had lost, General Peckham began sending out more USO troops than he had ever sent out before and assigned Colonel Cargill himself the responsibility of generating enough enthusiasm for them. But there was no enthusiasm in Yossarian's group. In Yossarian's group, there was only a mounting number of enlisted men and officers who found their way solemnly to Sergeant Towser several times a day to ask if the orders sending them home had come in. They were men who had finished their 50 missions. There were more of them now than when Yossarian had gone into the hospital, and they were still waiting. They worried and bit their nails. They were grotesque, like useless young men in a depression. They moved sideways like crabs. They were waiting for the orders sending them home to safety to return from 27th Air Force Headquarters in Italy, and while they waited, they had nothing to do but worry and bite their nails and find their way solemnly to Sergeant Towser several times a day to ask if the orders sending them home to safety had come. They were in a race and knew it, because they knew from bitter experience that Colonel Cathcart might raise the number of missions again at any time. They had nothing better to do than wait. Only Hungry Joe had something better to do each time he finished his missions. He had screaming nightmares and won fistfights with Hoople's cat. He took his camera to the front row of every USO show and tried to shoot pictures up the skirt of the yellow-headed singer with two big ones and a sequined dress that always seemed ready to burst. The pictures never came out. Colonel Cargill, General Peckham's troubleshooter, was a forceful, ruddy man. Before the war, he'd been an alert, hard-hitting, aggressive marketing executive. He was a very bad marketing executive. Colonel Cargill was so awful a marketing executive that his services were much sought after by firms eager to establish losses for tax purposes. Throughout the civilized world, from Battery Park to Fulton Street, he was known as a dependable man for a fast tax write-off. His prices were high, for failure often did not come easily. He had to start at the top and work his way down. And with sympathetic friends in Washington, losing money was no simple matter. It took months of hard work and careful misplanning. A person misplaced, disorganized, miscalculated, overlooked everything, and opened every loophole, and just when he thought he had it made, the government gave him a lake, or a forest, or an oil field, and spoiled everything. Even with such handicaps, Colonel Cargill could be relied on to run the most prosperous enterprise into the ground. He was a self-made man who owed his lack of success to nobody. "Men," Colonel Cargill began in Yossarian squadron, measuring his pauses carefully, "you're American officers, the officers of no other army in the world can make that statement. Think about it." Sergeant Knight thought about it, and then politely informed Colonel Cargill that he was addressing the enlisted men, and that the officers were to be found waiting for him on the other side of the squadron. Colonel Cargill thanked him crisply and glowed with self-satisfaction as he strode across the area. It made him proud to observe that 29 months in the service had not blunted his genius for ineptitude.
Men,
he began his address to the officers, measuring his pauses carefully.
You're American officers. The officers of no other army in the world could make that statement. Think about it.
He waited a moment to permit them to think about it.
These people are your guests,
he shouted suddenly.
They've traveled over 3,000 miles to entertain you. How are they going to feel if nobody wants to go out and watch them? What's going to happen to their morale? Now, men, it's no skin off my behind, but that girl that wants to play the accordion for you today is old enough to be a mother. How would you feel if your own mother traveled over 3,000 miles to play the accordion for some troops that didn't want to watch her? How is that kid whose mother that accordion player is old enough to be going to feel when he grows up and learns about it? We all know the answer to that one. Now, men, don't misunderstand me. This is all voluntary, of course. I'd be the last colonel in the world to order you to go to that USO show and have a good time. But I want every one of you who isn't sick enough to be in a hospital, to go to that USO show right now and have a good time. And that's an order!
Yossarian did feel almost sick enough to go back into the hospital, and he felt even sicker 3 combat missions later when Dr. Nika still shook his melancholy head and refused to ground him.
You think you've got troubles,
Dr. Nika rebuked him grievingly.
What about me? I've done peanuts for 8 years while I learned how to be a doctor. After the peanuts, I lived on chicken feed in my own office until I could build up a practice decent enough to even pay expenses. Then, just as the shop was finally starting to show a profit, they drafted me. I don't know what you're complaining about.
Dr. Nika was Yossarian's friend and would do just about nothing in his power to help him. Yossarian listened very carefully as Dr. Nika told him about Colonel Cathcart at Group, who wanted to be a general, about General Dreedle at Wing and General Dreedle's nurse, and about all the other generals at 27th Air Force Headquarters, who insisted on only 40 missions as a completed tour of duty.
"Why don't you just smile and make the best of it?"
he advised Yossarian glumly.
"Be like Havermeyer."
Yossarian shuddered at the suggestion. Havermeyer was a lead bombardier who never took evasive action going into the target and thereby increased the danger of all the men who flew in the same formation with him.
"Havermeyer, why the hell don't you ever take evasive action?"
they would demand in a rage after the mission.
"Hey, you men leave Captain Havermeyer alone,"
Colonel Cathcart would order.
"He's the best damned bombardier we've got."
Havermeyer grinned and nodded and tried to explain how he dum-dummed the bullets with a hunting knife before he fired them at the field mice in his tent every night. Havermeyer was the best damn bombardier they had, but he flew straight and level all the way from the IP to the target, and even far beyond the target, until he saw the falling bombs strike ground and explode in a darting spurt of abrupt orange that flashed beneath the swirling pall of smoke and pulverized debris geysering up wildly in huge rolling waves of gray and black. Havermeyer held mortal men rigid in 6 planes as steady and still as sitting ducks, while he followed the bombs all the way down through the plexiglass nose with deep interest, and gave the German gunners below all the time they needed to set their sights and take their aim and pull their triggers or lanyards or switches or whatever the hell they did pull when they wanted to kill people they didn't know. Havermeyer was a lead bombardier who never missed. Yossarian was a lead bombardier who had been demoted because he no longer gave a damn whether he missed or not. He had decided to live forever or die in the attempt, and his only mission each time he went up was to come down alive. The men had loved flying behind Yossarian, who used to come barreling in over the target from all directions and every height, climbing and diving and twisting and turning so steeply and sharply that it was all the pilots of the other five planes could do to stay in formation with him, leveling out only for the 2 or 3 seconds it took for the bombs to drop, and then zooming